Welcome back. And here we are with Charles M. Blow, who wrote his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And, of course, he's a columnist in New York Times, been there since as a columnist since 2008. As the graphic columnist. Is that what they called you?
Yeah, they call me visual. I just say columnist.
Okay, fine.
It's easier for me. It's shorter. It fits better on a business card.
It does that. What does that mean? That's right. Visual columnist. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at talk@steinershow.org. Hit me at Mark Steiner, or you can log on to our Facebook page. It's 410-319-8888 as we talk with New York Times columnist Charles Blow about his memoir. So, Charles, we've talked over the years, never really met, but over the years when you joined us by phone,
yes,
to talk about your columns that you've,
yes,
written. And so I'm really curious, after you read the book, it's obvious, I think, in some ways, but what drove you to write your memoir? I mean, what kind of pushed this piece? I mean, you've been writing about race and politics and many other things.
In a way, the book is those, encompasses those,
right,
themes as well, right?
Right.
But you know, I didn't start to write a book. I started writing kind of personal essay scenes from my life that I thought I would sell to a magazine or something. They would run them as little essays, but it wasn't until 2009. There were two little boys who killed themselves. They both hanged themselves. They were both 11 years,
right,
old.
Right.
They hanged themselves 10 days apart from each other. One was in Boston and one was in Atlanta. And they had been the subjects of unrelenting homophobic bullying. And I just thought, you know, this can't happen on my watch. I just, if there's something that I can do to stop this sort of pain, this sort of sorrow in the world, particularly among young children, that I should do that. And I knew what that felt like. I knew what it felt like to be bullied. I knew what it felt like to have ideations of suicide at a very young age. In my case, obviously, I didn't follow through. And I felt like I could, young children always have the language to know,
right,
How to express themselves, how to express their pain. They don't always write suicide notes, so you don't even know after they take their life why. And I have the language, and I felt that, you know, that was just my story, and I could write it, and I could write what it felt like to walk up to that point and walk back from it, and what the rest of that life looked like. It may not be easy, but it was a life, and you could learn to love yourself. And not like some kind of woeful acquiescence of acceptance, but just a full-throated embrace of self,
mm-hmm,
exuberant embrace of who you are, and love yourself and be loved by others and have a family if you so choose and have a career and make a mark on the world.
In many ways, the book is about, I mean, is kind of this struggle with the notion of what masculinity is.
Right.
What being a man means,
right,
both from being Southern and Black, but also in a broader sense,
yes,
beyond being Southern and Black.
Absolutely. I mean, the one of the themes of the book is to take on how perilously narrowly we draw masculinity in the collective,
right,
conscience.
Right.
That it is dangerously narrow. That it's like, you know, writing a note in a song so high that no one is only a few people are meant to hit it, and no one is meant to hold it. So
right,
that you know, so few men can ever achieve this ideal of what we now consider masculinity, because it's such a narrow, such a peak. And this book attempts, in some ways, to redraw it as broad. You know, that it's an ocean, and that in some places it is shallow, and in some places it is deep, in some places it is roiling, and in some places it is placid, and that all of that is masculinity. And when we redefine what it is to be male and allow men to be vulnerable and to feel pain and to hurt and to identify in a variety of ways and still feel that their masculinity is intact, that they are still men, frees us up.
It does free us up. And I like the journey you took us on in terms of the getting to the freeing up, or we'll also talk about the freeing up, but getting to the point where you felt like you were freeing up.
Yes.
But, I mean, part of the journey is, and I think it's important because there are a lot of boys, and men later, but mm-hmm. boys who grew up who are bright, like to read, like to let their imagination flow off,
right.
are kind of on the outside,
right.
Maybe skinny, maybe fat, maybe whatever,
yes.
but don't quite fit in.
Right.
And so that this, in some ways, it's not an uncommon tale,
yes.
but one that most people are afraid to tell, I think.
I think that is probably true. And, you know, that outsiderism,
that,
you know,
right.
where you're not the jock and where, you know, you are kind of hardwired to follow the strongest kid, the most outgoing kid, the one who can wrestle the other kids to the ground. I mean, that becomes what we identify as most masculine. And
right.
so we then order ourselves around this kind of alpha male archetype. And I'm this is to say that, you know, there are a lot of ways, there are many peaks along this mountain range. And when we reconsider it in that way and realize that, you know, the smart kid is also expressing himself and is you know, absolutely male and absolutely masculine, that the plasticity of masculinity is a real thing. And that we don't have to narrow it down to kind of meathead, caveman sensibilities. Then we all free ourselves, and we free these kids up because they're struggling, and many are hurt, and many are just, you know, you're just not physically made, you're not mentally made, you're not spiritually constructed to be this kind of caveman guy,
and that's
perfectly okay.
It's hard, but it's really hard for, as you write about, it's hard for young kids to go through that.
Yes, it's really hard.
Really hard.
Really hard.
And I don't think, until we, I'm going to come right to the heart of your story here, mm-hmm. but until I think we as a society and culture and as families understand, are willing to understand, remember our own stories,
right.
and understand how hard it is for children to go through what they're going through, we can't heal or change that. Maybe it can never be changed. I'm not sure, but... We can't even begin to do it.
We can't begin. And I think until we recognize the incredible amount of misogyny
yeah.
that we bathe all of our children in, we can't begin to understand it. And so the idea of the real man becomes the mirror opposite of anything that we perceive as feminine, because we order maleness and femininity as male being dominant and femininity always being less. And so anything that we register in a boy that
right.
is less than, you know, the strength, the archetypical guy, we say you are reduced by that. And that's the very definition of misogyny, right? And so until we get rid of this overriding misogyny, we can't heal these boys.
Nor ourselves. You have this great line later in the book where you just one line mm-hmm. where you say, misogyny just seemed to hang on men like the rancid smell of rotting meat.
Yes.
Whew. That's a very heavy line.
But it's true. And I think that we almost become immune to it. We can't sense it. We get immune to this concept that we're always surrounded by it, and that we are reinforcing it, and we always think of misogyny as being an oppressive thing for
right.
women, but it is an oppressive thing for men as well.
Thank
as
you.
Women.
Right. Hard for us to recognize, but it is.
Yes.
So you, as a young kid growing up in Louisiana, in this rural Louisiana, in segregated South. Well, it wasn't segregated anymore, but it might as well have been.
Well, it's segregated.
Right.
It's not,
it wasn't legally segregated.
It's not, right, right. It's not codified,
right.
but it was segregated.
Right, it was segregated.
Yes.
So, and I mean, your world that you grew up in, the thing I thought about as you wrote about your world was the beauty of the life in a small black community.
Yes.
Also the pain that lived within it.
Right.
But it was the power that came out of its survival and beauty that you also touch on with
right.
your mom and your dad, even though they split up and they had their things.
Yes, and they fight like cats and
dogs. And all the rest. The way you describe your Uncle Jed and your grandfathers,
yes.
I mean, that was a very kind of beautiful thing in that structure, that that family.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do, I mean, you know, Toni Morrison always talks about, you know, wanting to kind of strike the blow immediately from her first novel of not writing through the white gaze, that being free to just write because these are the people she knew and this is how she wanted to express herself and not feel like she had to narrate the story to a white person or through a white person's eyes, see it through a white person's eyes. And part of this was my attempt to do the same, which is to say, these are, you know, this black humanity is humanity. And these are just people. And I want to bring them alive. And they don't require juxtaposition to any other. That their worth is not relative to another person's worth. They are worthy in and of themselves, and they are human in and of themselves, and they are beautiful just by themselves. And it does not require me to show them as opposed to the white society that in which they live. And so because it's so isolated, I can do that. And it's natural. It's so very normal. It's the truth right. of it. You know, we lived in all black societies. I always say, you know, people say, you know, you moved to New York, was that really difficult? And you move out of your black world into a white world. And I said, you know, I don't understand what that even means because, you know, when I was growing up,
right.
because it was an all black world, I went to a historically black college. The black people are always the smartest people in the room. So this idea that black people shouldn't be the smartest people in the room, I just never got that. It was just my default expectation. Was that was a real possibility. So it strengthened me in a lot of ways.
And I, you know, the parts of it, let me just get through this real fast because I think they're important. I just want to set some of this up.
Mm-hmm.
But you're kind of going back and finding out about your grandfather, the war hero.
Yes.
And your family, the family stories about being descended from folks that stood up to white power and lived the life they wanted to live and
right.
were... And even to the point of you being maybe the same plantation from Dred Scott, the
yes.
same last name Blow.
Yes, yes.
I mean, all
yes.
these things help mold you.
Yes, yes.
As a young man, right?
It grounds you, gives you roots, right?
And
I think that's important to have because I think, you know, sometimes you can feel rudderless in the world if you don't have some sort of history to hold on to. And for many African Americans, because of slavery, a lot of that has been erased. But for my particular family, you know, I was able to find a lot of rootedness in these incredible people who were part of my life, and in particular, as you point out, incredible men who were part of my own family, and it allows me to paint black masculinity in a way that I don't see enough of in popular culture, in literature, in film, which is. They are heroes.
Like, Your grandfather was a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He was a war hero.
Like, not just like a regular guy who got a medal. Like an actual hero.
Jumping out of his truck, taking on the
yes.
Nazis, defending his
yes.
men, like, wounded in the field, you know, overnight, coming back.
One of the Buffalo Soldiers, one of the only all-black unit to see action on the ground in World War II. The first one of that division to get, I think it was a Silver Star and recommended for the higher office, although...
Distinguished Service Cross, but he didn't get it.
But didn't get it because, you know...
Surprise.
The guy, you know. Right. But, you know, these are, like, real heroes. And also men who love with all of their heart. You know, we don't see enough of that, who would give up everything for the woman that they love. We see a lot of that in other literature, but you don't always see that from black men in literature. And many of these men love with the whole of their heart and they would give up everything. And you see, you know, a great grandfather who does exactly that. He's earned this property and these white people are trying to run him off and take it away from him. And he has to decide, you know, do I keep this land that I have earned or do I go and be with the woman who I love? And he chooses the woman that he loves. I mean, it's yeah. just a powerful statement.
Yeah, right.
It's a powerful statement. And so, you know, I have all of that as part of my particular history, and it really informs how I look at the world.
And I love the pieces where you drove past the places that your family had owned and now owned by white people, and there's oil drills, gas drills, people making lots of money on this land that had been stolen. Your family had been pushed off. I mean, that was a really, it wasn't a huge piece of the book, but it was a very powerful,
it's important book. There's a lot of tension there because we're going to pray to make sure we have enough to eat, and like somebody's making millions
on this land.
Off the land that used to be ours.
So, now, you, one of the things here, before we go to break, I really want to put it out there now because it is your the entire struggle you had over the question of masculinity.
Right.
What happened with a trusted cousin, Chester?
Yes,
who you had you were there with your brothers who you didn't hang with as much. He was his cousin to hang with you for the summer.
Yes.
You thought you had this ace with you,
older guy. He's making me feel like one of the big boys, and then he betrays that trust one night, and I wake up in a kind of
because you're sharing the same bed.
Yes,
you had to
exactly
small house.
Small house, and,
right? Everybody shared a bed with somebody,
and you know, and there is kind of a sexually abusive episode there, and it like completely shocks and destroys me because I cannot figure out what's happening. Why is this person doing this? What have I done wrong that would make this happen? I can't find the words to even make it stop. Sometimes we think about that as an adult and you think, oh, you just say this, scream, you know what? But 7-year-old kid, you don't, there is no right because you're not thinking. It's such a traumatic thing that, and oppressive in the moment and every...
You were 7, he was 14. Do I remember that?
Yeah, I don't know the exact age, but he wasn't as close as old as my oldest brother, who was 8 years older than me, but he was, 6, 7, 8 years older than me. And, you just don't know what to do. And I do a lot of things that children who are the victims of childhood sexual abuse do. I try to figure out, have I done something? I blame myself. Retreat. I am completely crushed and devastated by it. And I think that, the next day I do find the words and say, I don't ever want to do that again. And from that point on, he never speaks a kind word to me ever again. And then starts to bully me. And that's how I so identify with those kids who had been bullied, because I felt it. And the bullying to me was even worse than the abuse itself, because the abuse was a one-time thing. I thought I would be able to kind of contextualize it and deal with it. But the bullying is all the time. It's not in the middle of the night. It's in the daylight. You cannot escape it. And that was even more hurtful to me.
And calling you a punk, which in the black community has a different connotation than in the white community.
Right, right.
Which meant you were gay, you were feminine.
Right. And it was kind of his way of saying to me, there is something about you that made me do this.
Right.
You invited this. You sparked something in me that made me do this. And it is part of your nature, and therefore it is your fault.
And I mean, and this really did lead to kind of this lifelong struggle.
Right.
For you.
Right. Well, right. And I think many victims of childhood sexual abuse, it causes confusion about because it takes away your natural progression to who you would most naturally be. And you can never get it back. It catapults you into a new sexual reality over kind of normal progress, where you would slowly come to like someone, and maybe you would hold a hand and get a kiss, and maybe like all these kind of very sweet little natural innocent things that kids do as they become fully realized sexual, loving, intimate beings. You no longer have that, and you can never get that back. And so now you have to question, what would that have looked like if it had actually been able to play itself out? And is where I ended up where I would always have ended up? But I can't know it for sure because the process was taken from me.
Right. So that struggle about who you are sexually, is kind of
The kid. And you can understand why kids do this.
Right.
They immediately kind of intuitively link abuse to identity, to intimacy, and it can take the rest of your life to unbraid those things.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, I think that it does. And I want to explore that in greater depth here, because I think that this is something that people, we all wrestle with our sexuality as we kind of grow into it and what that means.
Yes,
and
how
we perform and who we are attracted to and why and how we looked at, because you might be the geek and nobody wants you. And you, some people kind of shrivel up and some people try to become the alpha male.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And we'll talk about what you did in a moment when we come back from this break. We're going out here with this break with Sly and the Family Stone. I want to take you higher. Jerry Martini, born on this day in 1943, saxophonist for the great Sly and Family Stone. We're here with Charles M. Blow about his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Pizzas and Herb, Shake Your Groove Thing. Herb Fain was born in 1942 in Anacostia in D.C. And his name was not then. His name was Herbert Feimster. Might change my name, too. I don't know. I'm just teasing. Fire Shut Up in My Bones by the New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow is in the studio, 410-319-8888. So, I mean, and so part of this, I mean, you spend a lot of time in this book also talking about your loneliness.
Right.
It comes out in every chapter. I mean, something happens that kind of reinforces this notion of you being lonely,
right,
even when you got to alpha land as a male. Alpha male land, I should say.
We'll get to that. Get that right. Correct that.
Don't want to put you in the wrong place. Sorry. Even though you won't identify it in the book, we don't want to put you in the wrong place. So, but you talk a lot about the loneliness, and I think that whether it was from your siblings or how you felt in school, or even when you were getting to the point where you were like top dog on some levels,
right,
it was still lonely because it wasn't real. I mean, there was this. So that permeates this whole book.
Right. There is a detachment that I learned. I mean, early in the book that I say that, you know, kind of loneliness becomes my closest friend and the one that would trail me for the rest of my life. And I do still kind of will event, you know, sometimes fade into darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And I like this kind of alone time. And now I think, oh, well, maybe it's just the writer in me, because, you know, these hermetic lifestyles that writers lead, and they have these huts in the middle of the woods and they go there and write. Well, maybe it helps me as a writer. But I do still like some alone time. And I'm always trying to struggle with and balance whether or not it is depressive.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it is just needing quiet space. And, you know, I don't always have the answer to that.
You don't always have the answer.
I don't always have the answer to that.
Right. Well, that's part of what, even the riddle of your own kind of sexuality, there is not always an answer to that.
No.
Right?
I mean, well, there's certainly not the, you know, kind of lazy binary answers to it, which is that we want people to be either or, you're on this team or that team. You know, which team are you batting for? That sort of nonsense.
Because we
want things to be easy and simple, and binaries make things yes, no, easy, simple, left, right, you know, Republican, Democrat, anything. It just makes it easy.
Right.
And that is simply not the way sexuality expresses itself in the human experience. Human beings are sexual beings. That sexuality expresses itself in a myriad of ways. It is not hierarchical, you know, from better to worse. It is spectral. It is from one side to another. And different people are, you know, at different points along that spectrum, and some people are fluid across that spectrum. They can move depending on circumstance, depending on the person that they meet, depending on what point they are in their life. And if we can accept that, then we understand that we have to do a lot more work to understand the person who we are with, the person we are interested in, the person who is talking to us. and understand that complexity, and also for people who are maybe in the middle or maybe fluid across the spectrum, coming to understand yourself and understand that you have to do work to understand yourself and to articulate yourself about who you are, and learning that you can just be honest in that moment to say, this is the history of me, and this is the current me as I understand me to be. And tomorrow that me may be different, but I can be honest today about this person, and I don't have to have absolute resolution in order to be articulate.
And the honesty part, being honest with yourself as a man, as a human being,
yes,
is critical.
Yes, yes. There's no way to be a whole man without being an honest
man. That's the
man.
Line you use in the book.
There's no
right,
way.
Right. Right. None. So, you know, that. So I was going to say it must have been difficult to write this book, but I'm not sure it was difficult to write this book. For yourself to kind of put out there.
The revelation, people keep asking me if the revelations were somehow difficult. They weren't, actually.
Right, right.
This is a lived experience. I'm not 14 years old. I'm not 24 years old. I'm 44 years old. This is not like, there's no news happening for me in this book. The difficulty was completely literary, that worrying that I was writing it well.
And you did.
Thank you.
And you did. And before we come back to this thing and your Uncle Paul and where you end up, the struggles you ended up with, I go back because part of the context of this is your mom and your dad and your mother who liked to tell stories, your mother who took very little guff off of other people.
Yes.
Had her gun and her brass knuckles.
Oh, yes.
I mean, and your dad... Who found out about that when...
Mom was tough.
She was tough, but it's interesting. This is what was really interesting, because we've had discussions on the show about corporal punishment before. Mm-hmm. And what happened to your grandmother when your grandfather died, who you loved very deeply, and how it changed her.
Yes.
And she got deep into her corporal punishment way. You wrote about how your mom was not into corporal punishment. She was tough, but that's not...
Yes, my mom was like kind of... still rebelling against my grandmother in a way. So everything that my grandmother would do, my mom would do the opposite of it. So the fact that my grandmother was into corporal punishment, my mom rarely spanked. Like, it was just, she wouldn't do it, but she would tell us stories about her being spanked by her mom, and she really did not like it. She did not think it was fair. She did not think it was a loving way to deal with a child. but at the same time, you know, this dichotomy in my mom, which is that she did not have the same patience with adults. You know, if she felt like you were being disrespectful or you were wrong, you were going to find the wrath of hell at your door. Like, that was the way that was going to happen. So, you know, it's a very interesting character.
It seems like really, I mean, and a woman who, I mean, you talk about how poor everybody was, but how you grew your own food and had these hogs in the back.
Yes.
But she worked her way through. She, when she kicked your father out and said, I'm done.
Yes.
And here's the gun saying, you are done.
Yes.
Leave.
Yes.
Went back to college. She just. Yeah.
Well, she was even going to college then
when
she was with my dad. Like, I have never known my mother not to go to take a class of some sort. Even today, like, she's retired, but she's elected to the school board. She's like, I re-elected. Congratulations, Mom.
Congratulations.
And, but she still takes classes. She cannot stop herself. So she'd, like, go to, like, the local craft store and make wreaths. And so there's, like, wreaths everywhere in the house. Like, she can't stop taking classes because it has been so instrumental in her life and had a material effect. Like, you could see, I could see as a child, which was very instructive for me, like, that education was not an abstraction. I could see that if she did this, she got more pay, she was better off, and we were better off. And so she saw how that played out in her life, and so she's just been kind of addicted to learning.
So the other part of the family was, I mean, that I think is important, because this is, again, only unique because you wrote about it, not unique in the world, which is why I think it's so important, right, which was the violence.
Yes.
That people take to violence to respond to things that happen around them and not afraid of fighting, not afraid of people coming at you, going to come right back at them, and even if it means you take somebody out.
Yes, yes, right? Yes. And there's a kind of vigilante justice in a place like, particularly small towns. This is a small rural town in the South. There's just one police officer. I mean, he was my cousin, and like, he worked 9 to 5, and he would go home, and there was a car. The police car was parked at his house at 5 o'clock. So there's no one. There's no one to call. No one called. Like, I write in a story, you know, people didn't call the police when a bad thing happened. They called when the body fell.
Right.
That was kind of the kind of ethos of this place. And people felt very much obliged to take justice into their hand if they felt that you had done them wrong.
And I think that's an important piece. I mean, it's peace of America as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, there's so many pieces in here. And so I really want to get to, because I think they're all connected. And when you go to Grambling and you made a choice to go to this institution not far from your home
in
Louisiana, that was a powerful turning point.
Yes.
On many levels.
Yes. Yes. It's kind of a finding of self. I meet all of the children of the Great Migration. So these are all the people who had moved away from the South and they sent their kids back to school here, and they're bringing all these experiences that I had never experienced, and so I'm kind of like experiencing all of America through their eyes, and learning that I have voice and that I have that I have an influence on them the same way that they're having an influence on me. And you know, it's just a magical time. I think college in general is magical for kids, because most of us we're away from home and living on our own. But it was truly a transformative period in my life.
One of the things about this, I think that I'm going to step back from the college, but come right back to it. I think what happened to you in the frats and hazing is illustrative of the struggle around that, but also the question of sexuality.
Yeah.
But what happened to you when you finally got to school, I think it was junior high school. Mm-hmm. I remember the kind of sequence of events. But what began to change when you were the kid who was lonely and picked on and bullied, which is why you have such an affection for bullied kids. And Russell and Alonzo come along.
Yes.
And they change the dynamic of your life.
Completely.
It's just
in a moment.
What peers can do.
In a flash.
Right.
In a flash. You know, I show up as the new kid, and I had met Russell. Now, Russell's the jock. Like, Russell's the kid that all the boys want to be. And he's a kid that all the girls want to date. And I mean, even though you're fourth grade or third grade. But still, like, he is the jock. And I had met Russell the summer before I transferred back to this school. And I didn't even know I didn't even think that he would be in my class or my grade. I didn't even think anything about it. I met him. His grandfather was an amateur electrician. He came over. My mom wanted to get an air conditioner because it was impressively hot that summer in Louisiana. And the grandfather botched the electrical job or whatever. That's neither here nor there. But we wrestled and played. And we how boys can become like fast friends. Like we were immediately drawn to each other, friends from the beginning. And I show up and he is in my grade. And he begins to vouch for me. Like, this guy's so cool. And immediately, I'm the cool kid. And I have been the outsider my entire life. And then there's always the jock cool kid. And then there's the smart, rich kid, well-dressed kid. So there's Alonzo. So Alonzo does not take well to this idea that somebody's being anointed who happens to be smart as well. So, you know, within the first couple of days, there's a fight. And as is often the case, the kid you have your first fight with becomes your best friend. So I am now the kind of grout between the jock, popular kid, and the smart, cool kid. And so I become a cool kid, having never experienced that in my life.
And so you, in some ways, from that point on, in school especially, you stay on top.
Yes.
And basketball.
I had to be best at everything because they had assumed that I was, and I just kind of assumed that position.
And stayed in it. Even when you went to, when you decided to pledge.
Yes. Yes, you had to be best at everything. So.
You still like that, probably.
I think that's the problem. Like, I think I have to work on this. To wind this back a little bit.
So, but a couple of things that I think are important to kind of talk about how people change and where they move. And I think that the whole question about pledging, as you write, by being fortified by trauma, but then you really describe the hazing process in gruesome detail.
Yes.
In this frat that remains nameless in your book. But if you read the book and know black frats, you'll figure out which one it is.
you gotta get me killed.
but But then you kind of take you seem to be really mixed about when you were president of this frat, when all this came down saying no more hazing in black fraternities,
right.
the way you were doing it, had to have a different process, and the underground that took place around that,
right.
because it was kind of this thing. You seem to be love the process of hazing, but hate it.
I mean, I never loved it.
You know, what I mean is accepting it as something.
Well, I mean, I bought into the mythology, right? Which is that this is the only way you can build lasting bonds, which is the line you're fed. And, you know, now that I'm 44 years old and I have so many lasting friendships and, you know, beautiful relationships with people.
It didn't entail paddling and being beaten up.
Nothing to do with trauma. Right. It has nothing to do with paddles and 2x4s and none of that nonsense. So you know that. As an adult, you know that this is completely possible and that, you know, but as young men, you very often want a proving situation. You want a moment where you can demonstrate that you can survive, that you can last, and you're being told that this is the one way that bonding can truly take place and last, and that it has been thus forever, and you just buy into that. And I think that I wanted to treat that very soberly in the book and not kind of in a passing way, because I think that hazing is a very real thing. It's not just black fraternity. It's not just fraternities, sororities at all. It is everything. It is the military. It is sports teams. It is, you know, when you look at surveys of the number of people who say that they have been hazed, it's all sorts of situations that people just take it as a normal part of who we are. And I think that not only is it dangerous, which I do believe that it is dangerous for the people who are being hazed, I think it is morally corrosive for the person who is doing it.
That's it. And which is why you didn't participate as much as you could have
right. And also, was it kind of not your job? You know, part of being, you know, president or whatever is to make sure that you don't, so nobody gets hurt or whatever. But even then, I got to a point where I was just like, Charles, this is not you. You just have to you have to let this go. You have to step back away from this. I called a meeting and I just resigned.
It's pretty heavy to do.
Yeah.
But I want to come back to some of these are so many pieces in here that I think that relate to other human beings. You talk about the struggle inside yourself. Mm-hmm. Let me just read this piece.
Mm-hmm.
You say, with no new girl to fixate on, I turn my attention to maintaining the person I had become while paying respect to the person I used to be, and on pretending to be the big cat, in quotes, while still looking out for the underdog. I began to negotiate a fine social line, thin as a kite string, being between soaring and remaining grounded, between being a popular boy and remembering that I had once felt like an invisible one.
Right. Right. I mean, and that was a constant negotiation for me. I mean, I intuitively gravitate to the underdog. And even today, in a lot of my writing in the column is always about this underdog kind of archetype, the vulnerable person. And in that passage, I talk about there was a kid who suffered from mental retardation, and he would, it's a small school, and, you know, the word was that his mom beat him so much that he hid underneath the house with the dogs because, you know.
And you became his protector.
And I became sort of a protector because I understood, you know, it felt like he wanted to say something he didn't have the words for, and I knew exactly what that felt like. He wanted to say something, he just didn't know what to say.
So when you were abused by both your Uncle Paul and by Chester, you understood that.
I understood it.
And I was also understanding how you talk about it early in the book where your mother asked you to go get a gun when she was really pissed off and was going to go after your father, one of his mistresses.
Yes, yes.
And you talk about that you thought you could never use a gun, but then when you realized Chester had come back into your life by visiting your mother's house, I think it was.
Right.
You were about to kill him.
Right. It's the same.
You were 20 years old, right?
It was like 20 years old. Replay of the same episode, just different. You know, I had to kind of summon the same strength that my mom had that day when she just kind of stopped herself and stopped chasing, you know, my father's women and her own demons. And I think we all have this power to release the pain that we feel and to walk away from it and to say, I use the word forgiveness. People may use a different word for that, but it is about releasing and allow stop hating someone else so that you can start loving yourself, because love and hate are such enormous emotional experiences that they can't coexist in the same body. There's just not enough room. You have to release one to pick up the other.
So when you write about what happened with your Uncle Paul, who was mentally deficient and had dual difficulties.
Right.
Or chest tumor.
Good question. I don't know if he's mentally, but he couldn't read or write.
Right.
For sure.
He had some issues.
Yes. Never left home.
Right.
Yes.
Or with your cousin Chester. Mm-hmm. As a young. So, and you see this happening. We see this happening in the world today, mm-hmm. with young boys. Let's say, let's talk about boys for a moment, mm-hmm. who are sexually molested at some level. What should happen then? How should we begin to respond to that? What happens to the person who does the molesting, or should happen to the person who does the molesting?
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand that the way we conceive of childhood sexual abuse is not always the way that it is. I mean, we always think of Jerry Sandusky, To Catch a Predator, and some grown man shows up with, you know, beer and condoms, and there's a teenager in the house who's been chatting with online. That's kind of the way we think of it. But if you look at the numbers, the number one age of sexual abusers is not an adult. It's 14 years old.
Right. So that's why I'm asking that.
Right. And half of all abused children are under the age of 12. And of that cohort under age of 12, the number one age is 4 years old. So when we have to first come to realize that there's a tremendous amount of abuse in America. 70% of all sexual assaults are against children, not adults. And that is very often one child, an older child,
right,
and a younger child. And then we have to figure out, okay, what do we do about this? How do we treat that older child? How do we treat the victim? How do we give them space to articulate and to grow and to have an opportunity to say what is happening in their life, what has happened to them, and to bounce back from it. How do we punish a child? Because,
right,
you know, they're also below the age of consent, even though they've done something really, really wrong. It's a very fraught and very complicated situation. But I do believe the first step is to drag this out of the darkness. I think that all childhood sexual abuse depends on silence and darkness. And we kind of have a collective psychological gag reflex to even discussing childhood sexual abuse, so that when a child is sexually abused, they always feel like they are the first person in the universe.
Right. And it's their fault.
That it has ever happened to, and therefore it must be their fault, because that person didn't choose another person. They chose them.
So, you know, a lot of people focus on your struggle, your own struggle around sexuality, heterosexual, bisexual. Mm-hmm. You love women mm-hmm. more than you love men, and mm-hmm. men really don't attract you that way, but they're always in your head.
Right.
Where did it come from?
Right.
All those things that you're wrestling with,
right,
as a man. But to me, the most important pieces in this book are not that,
right,
even though that's a huge piece of
sure.
it. But it's A, where you came from, and the struggles in that community you came from.
There are many pillars in this.
Many pillars in this book that are really important, and I defining what masculinity means.
Right.
But this whole question of what we do with young children,
right,
who are confused sexually, commit acts. I mean, this happens more than we want to let it on.
No,
it happens all the time.
All the time.
Our children, somebody else's children,
yes,
happens all the time.
Yes.
Right?
Often in your house. By someone that you know.
So the question is, we don't want as a society to figure out how to wrestle with this, yes, other than in some punitive sense, or to sweep it under the rug and not talk about it.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
We got to find a new way to do this.
We have to find a new way. And another thing that I, you know, it's important, I think, for parents to remember is that, you know, you hear a lot of parents say, if this ever happened to my child, I would kill this,
right,
person, I would hurt this,
right,
person. Remember that that is actually working against that child ever telling you that something has ever happened to them. Because what the child, you have to think the way the child thinks. This is a person that the family loves. This is a person that is in our home, if not permanently, often. And if they have heard you say that you would hurt, you would kill, blah, 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 this person, they're basically saying, if I say something, that means somebody gets hurt.
Right.
That's exactly what Maya Angelou says in Why Do Kids Burn Sage.
Right.
That's
right.
Why she never said anything. That's why a
right.
lot of kids never say anything, because
right.
they believe that the very act of speaking will cause harm to another person, and they won't.
Right. No, I understand that completely. I mean, I won't go into detail in there, but it's happened to my family, it's happened to many families.
Right.
I mean, this is not a new thing.
Right.
And so that's why I think it's so important what you're raising here, and I really hope that part of what the struggle you bring to us next out of this book
sure.
is how we as society wrestle with this particular part, both
right.
how we define what it means to be a man or masculinity,
right.
which get out of this stupid jock mode of
right.
what it means to be tough and strong,
right.
and also about our children
right.
who are experiencing these things every day and how that affects them as adults and how we put this, put our hands around it now and not when they're 18, 19,
exactly.
25, 30 years old and confused and
exactly.
crazy and whatever
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I just think that it's you know that the book really affected me very deeply, and I,
thank you.
It was a I you know I wasn't when I started to tell you this, Charles, when I first read it, I was going, what is he trying to tell me here? What's he doing with this book? Really well written. I like well, what's he saying, but then and really well. I mean, I love your writing, and
thank you.
But then it unfolded, and I think it's a very important memoir.
Thank you, I appreciate that,
and a very scary one because I think. Whether it's the black community or the national community as a whole, we have to wrestle with the issues you raised.
Yes.
About masculinity and who we are and
right.
our sexuality
right.
and what happens to our children.
Yes.
So what comes next?
Oh, you, what is that?
What,
I don't
what's
know
next?
That question. What is the kind of question is that?
Just messing with just
lunch.
Okay. Lunch should be good. So tonight, let me just say that Charles Blow will be staying in Baltimore today. Why he's here, coming through town, is because he'll be speaking tonight at the Enoch Pratt Central Library in the Wheeler Auditorium at 400 Cathedral Street. The open forum is part of the OSI Baltimore's Talking About Race series, co-sponsored by the Enoch Pratt Library. More information at calendar.prattlibrary.org/event. That'll be on our website. Or just show up. It starts at 7. It's not on here, but it's at 7 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
So just... get there by 6:30. I encourage you all to get there by 6:30 because it fills up quickly and you want to get in there. There could be a line wrapped around the library. You want to get there as early as you can, get your seat, settle in. There's usually an overflow room if more people are there. But it's a conversation you do not want to miss that we're having tonight with Charles Blow. You're just speaking, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, yes, yes.
Not just. I mean, you're speaking.
Yeah.
No, you're just speaking, right?
however you want to say it, Mark.
Fire Shut Up in My Bones, memoir by Charles M. Blow, the New York Times columnist. Phenomenal book. Thank you so much for coming by the studio.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Getting here early in Baltimore today. I appreciate you coming by.
Yes.
Thank you. So, folks, we'll take a brief break. We're going to go to break here with Donny Hathaway. Someday we'll all be free. He was born on this day in 1945 in Chicago, raised by his grandmother in St. Louis, Missouri. The great Don Hathaway, one of my favorite singers of all time. Enjoy him during the break. We'll be right back. Just